is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, after 8 years of the Obama presidency, President Trump has taken over the reins in Washington in what looks like to be an entirely new approach to health reform.
Well, Mark, we've seen many changes in the healthcare industry over the years, but I wonder if any have been as dramatic as the changes that we've seen over these last years of the Affordable Care Act. Really a lot of improvements in health quality. So we are fervently hoping to maintain some of these positive progressions.
We thought it would be a great time to bring in a highly respected health policy analyst, Dr. Mark McClung, the former administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid under President George W. Bush.
And hopefully we'll bring some unique insights to this evolving landscape in health reform as we move forward from this point on.
And we also have Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org, who's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we love hearing from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Mark McClung in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Health and Human Services Secretary nominee Dr. Tom Price took a grilling at his confirmation hearing, largely surrounding his investment portfolio and plans for replacing the Affordable Care Act. Price, who reportedly had made several investments in medical device and pharmaceutical companies who then benefited from legislation he introduced, claimed he didn't know what investments were being made by his broker. Congressman Price said he would work to ensure the vulnerable still had access to health care after the law was repealed, though when pressed for details, he didn't indicate how that would happen. Meanwhile, a majority of Americans gain health coverage through their employers, and they're also likely to see some changes to that coverage under repeal of the Affordable Care Act. A number of ACA-driven benefits could go away, including what's known as essential benefits. All preventive screenings are covered with no copay, no annual caps on insurance payouts, no lifetime limits on payouts for catastrophic illness. All of those are at risk. The world's economic influencers gathered in Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Summit. A coalition of government and health leaders and philanthropists from around the world has launched a preemptive strike against the next global pandemic. They formed the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness, the goal to outsmart future epidemics with a fund to develop new vaccines. Bill Gates saying the Ebola and Zika virus outbreak showed how, quote, woefully ill-prepared the world is to tackle the next emergent threat. Also from Davos, a look forward. Health forecasters seeing continued growth in the digital health arena. Some trends that will likely gain traction. Financial innovations for funding a sustainable future global health economy, including greater reliance on sugar and tobacco tariffs. Encouraging accountability for a more open and transparent health system, which should lead to better outcomes. And more advanced applications of new personalized and genomic medicine technology, 3D printing and robotic surgery also look to see tremendous growth in the health sector moving forward. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Mark McClung, director of the Robert J. Margolis Center for Health Policy at Duke University. Dr. McClung served as the former administrator at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, as well as commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration under President George W. Bush. Also a senior fellow and director of Healthcare and Value Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Board certified in internal medicine, Dr. McClung earned his MD from the Harvard MIT Division of Health Science and Technology. Dr. McClung, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Mark, Margaret, great to talk.
As someone who knows the inner workings of the federal government and the process of advancing tough policy initiatives like health reform, what do you believe are the most significant changes we're likely to see coming from the Trump administration and Congress?
It's probably no accident that healthcare has continued to be a very important policy issue, the area where the federal government is spending the most money. And on the other hand, medical care can do more and more to extend lives and really add a lot of value for our economy as well. So where we are likely to see things head in this next round is more of a push in the direction towards less of a role and requirement set by the federal government, towards a bigger role for states. But I'd also emphasize that there is some common ground among Democrats and Republicans. For example, Dr. Price, although strong critic of the Affordable Care Act, Secretary of Health and Human Services, will be implementing a bipartisan law that he sponsored to significantly reform the way physicians are paid in Medicare, and it has implications throughout the healthcare system with the goal of trying to create more value. So areas where there is a lot of disagreement, but also there will be other policy reforms taking place that have more bipartisan support.
Well, Dr. McClellan, if we polled most Americans today, we'd probably find that they had tended to focus more on things which had a direct impact on them today from the Affordable Care Act. But there was so much more. One of the important areas were payment reform initiatives within the ACA that some would say have led to some real savings, whether within Medicare or the growth of accountable care organizations. Help our audience understand some of these payment reform initiatives that we saw under the ACA.
When I was starting in CMS, I had lots of meetings with healthcare providers around the country that were trying to do the right thing for their patients, answering emails by setting up teams to take care of their patients, hiring nurses, social workers who could do things that physicians don't have time to do. And what a lot of these efforts had in common was that they led to better outcomes for their patients, and they led to lower costs for Medicare, but Medicare didn't pay for any of that stuff. So instead, what we set up was an early version of what became something like the accountable care organizations today, where we made a deal with a pilot set of healthcare providers, which was that if they could track how their population of Medicare beneficiaries were doing on things like controlling their diabetes and they were preventing avoidable hospitalization, and at the same time, if the overall Medicare costs were lower, those kinds of programs have evolved with bipartisan support in legislation like MACRA into a much more widespread use of new kinds of payment models today. And that was part of the Affordable Care Act. I do think in the new administration and with more of a, I want to call it a Republican flavor, you might see more efforts to build on what CMS has done already to align with things going on in the private sectors. And I also think more of an emphasis on payment reforms that get to the consumer side of things. If patients choose less costly ways to get their care, more ways for them to share in the savings as well.
Dr. McClellan, President Trump recently said that everyone would have insurance. House Speaker Paul Ryan has a different view about how to repeal and replace creating high-risk pools, eliminating the Medicaid expansion. And what type of advice would you give to the nation's network of community health centers, which care for some 24 million Americans, on how they should think strategically and prepare themselves for the changes that are afoot?
Well, community health centers have seen the program grow steadily over the last couple of decades with, I would add, this is another area where there is some bipartisanship, support for community health centers and increased funding. And because their role is really important, from primary care type services towards now playing integral roles, in some cases leading true population care management approaches, like being part of accountable care organizations and being the medical home for a network of care in conjunction with specialists in their region, particularly for vulnerable patients. And in states that haven't expanded Medicaid, the community health centers are developing more efficient networks to deliver care as best they can in the absence of much insurance coverage. I think those kinds of steps are going to continue to get bipartisan support and attention. If there is, for example, more shift towards state flexibility and how they provide care for lower income and vulnerable residents, one might expect a greater reliance on efficient community health center-based networks. And similarly, if some of the reforms that take place in the exchanges are really kind of pushing towards more efficient ways of delivering care, that too may feature a bigger role for community health centers in reformed health plans. So I think that the future is both challenging but also bright in some ways for community health centers. The more they're able to expand from focusing only on what happens when the patient's in your office to what's really going on with helping the patient to prevent complications and get the best health outcomes and avoid unnecessary costs, that's a constructive direction for health centers too.
Well, Dr. McClellan, there was a recent report from the Congressional Budget Office that predicted a large jump in the number of uninsured Americans and a rise in uncompensated care. What do you think governors and state legislators should be doing or considering as they plan for potential changes in their policies and budgets?
Well, I'd say first, what the Congressional Budget Office recently reported was that if all that happened in Congress was repealing the funds for Medicaid expansion that came with the Affordable Care Act, lots of people would drop coverage, the insurance markets would become unstable, and we'd end up with very high rates of uninsurance. I think the Republicans have very pointedly emphasized that that is not their plan. Their plan is repeal and replace. But we are right now just at the beginning of that legislative process with just the first steps towards real repeal happening. What needs to happen is more clarity around how proposals like Speaker Ryan's would work. Does have a tax credit for people to buy insurance with more competition and a bigger role for states in assisting low-income individuals, people with high health care needs. That proposal is not yet completely fleshed out into legislative language to not just repeal key provisions of the Affordable Care Act, but to replace with a model that depends on steps like staying continuously enrolled and having support available for people who have higher health care needs. And I know the president-elect has talked about how he wants this to happen sooner rather than later, encouraging the two sides in Congress to come together. This is an issue that's a very important topic that will continue to be debated for the foreseeable future.
We're speaking today with Dr. Mark McClellan, director of the Robert J. Margolis Center for Health Policy at Duke University. Dr. McClellan served as the former administrator at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid, as well as commissioner of the FDA under President George W. Bush. He also served on the President's Council of Economic Advisors. And Dr. McClellan, I'd like to pull on your expertise around economics. As you know, healthcare constitutes about one-fifth of the nation's GDP, and the American Hospital Association has warned that the industry could suffer up to $160 billion in setbacks in the short term, and other analysts estimate a complete repeal of the ACA could lead to 3 million jobs lost in health. And I'm sure that both the Trump administration and Congress are going to take these economic impact into consideration as they think through health reform.
Well, one thing we can say for sure, the numbers are big. There are a lot of people affected, even though it's only around 10% of the U.S. population. It's 21 million people with coverage related to the ACA. Republicans have been stressing that this is not just about taking away funding and destabilizing current insurance markets, but rather about replacing it with something that does provide a good, less costly alternative. What we're talking about, though, in terms of job growth from the hospital side is really about slowing the growth rate. So even through the recession, this is a great recession, the biggest slowdown in the economy, hospitals and the healthcare sector continued to add jobs. It was one of the bright spots over the years following the 2008 market crash. So a reform would affect our hospitals, but some of the reforms have behind them the idea of changing the way that care is delivered. Social services and supports, mental and behavioral services that could head off emergency room visits for patients with poorly controlled mental illnesses, or care coordination services that might involve a nurse practitioner or a pharmacist. I feel pretty confident about the overall future of the healthcare industry, but I do think that some new directions for hospitals and for healthcare employment are probably good for the economy in terms of creating new kinds of jobs. and also good for the well-being of Americans.
Dr. McClellan, one aspect of the high cost of healthcare that got a lot of attention in the past several months was drug prices. You served as commissioner of the FDA, so you know perhaps better than anyone in the country the complexity of drug pricing and certainly the intricacies of the pharmaceutical industry. How can we meaningfully bring drug costs down without harming research and development pipelines?
It's important to remember that there are a set of different issues going on that are contributing to high drug costs. Some of the drugs that have made the most news, like EpiPen and others, are generic drugs where there really isn't a reason why other drug manufacturers couldn't come in and make a similar drug and have some real price competition. And there is actually bipartisan legislation now in Congress to try to encourage steps that would do that. Steps like giving the FDA more support to approve new competing drugs and make it easier for generic drug manufacturers to get a quick and predictable approval to market drugs where there is a need for more competition, to improve the availability of low-cost generic alternatives where we're not seeing good competition now. There are also opportunities coming for biologic drugs, some of the most expensive drugs that are much more complex to manufacture. So-called biosimilar drugs are starting to come on the market in the United States, and there are opportunities for perhaps, by some estimates, $50 billion in savings of very similar medication, some real opportunities for bringing costs down. I think we're going to see in the coming months and years more attention to these same kinds of reforms that we were talking about earlier. Primary care doctors, oncologists, hospitals, others are moving into payment models where they pay more for actually getting better results for patients. So far, those models have more or less excluded prescription drugs and also medical devices, even though the incremental cost of producing another pill is quite low, and the real value is in the intellectual property in the molecule itself and in knowing how to use it in particular patients. So drugs seem to me to be a good opportunity for new payment models that are more aligned with this shift to greater value. Imagine if a drug manufacturer was paid more for getting better results in the population that's using the medication.
Dr. McClellan, we recently hosted your former Duke colleague, Dr. Victor Zhao, on the show, who's now the director of the National Academy of Medicine. He was very complimentary about not only your work that you've been doing in value-driven health approach, but that you're a great example of how bipartisan approach can actually work to advance good policy. And I'm wondering where you see that seam of opportunity and collaboration.
Well, I think it is hard to get healthcare right. Again, the biggest component of the federal budget now, and even though there's some disagreements on very important issues like how the Medicaid program should work for low-income Americans, some of this is reflected in a recent report that Victor Zhao and I worked on at the National Academy of Medicine on vital directions for healthcare. This report had recommendations in three major areas, steps to improve population health, bringing traditional healthcare more into population health, and improving long-term outcomes at a lower cost. Second area is changing the way that we pay and finance healthcare, but at least payment models that are less burdensome administratively on providers, paying for things like extended office hours or converting their office visits to telemedicine or just remote patient monitoring. And then a third area is in our education and research programs. Most of our training dollars right now goes into the traditional ways of running a lab, of delivering care in a hospital, not as part of a team. There's some good educational models emerging, taking advantage of big data, large-scale research networks, team-based approaches to healthcare. All of these areas have considerable bipartisan support, but do require policy changes. But there are also a lot of opportunities for bipartisan legislation to get to better health for the country and to help get healthcare costs down.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Mark McClellan, director of the Robert J. Margolis Center for Health Policy at Duke University. You can learn more about his work by going to healthpolicy.duke.edu. Dr. McClellan, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you all. Great to talk to you, Mark, Margaret, about these important topics.
At Conversations on Healthcare. We want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
As President Obama leaves office, we looked back at fact-checking the 44th president, and healthcare headlined the biggest falsehoods of Obama's tenure. Back in 2009, he promised, quote, if you like your healthcare plan, you keep your healthcare plan. We wrote then that Obama couldn't keep that promise for everyone. And in 2013, reality caught up with the president. After the minimum benefit standards were set, the ACA marketplace opened for business on October 1st, 2013. Almost immediately, some individual market policyholders began to receive cancellation notices from their insurance companies. By November 14, 2013, Obama announced a temporary fix to address the problem and admitted that he had made some assumptions about the law that were incorrect. Also in 2009, Obama claimed in a speech to Congress that an insurance company was responsible for the death of an Illinois cancer patient. It wasn't. The insurance company did briefly cancel the man's coverage, but his sister said the interruption lasted a few weeks, and shortly after, the man was able to get a successful stem cell transplant that extended his life by 3.5 years. And another Obama anecdote turned out not to be true in 2011. Obama had long told the story about his mother's battles with her health insurance carrier. He claimed that she was nearly denied health insurance coverage for a pre-existing condition while she was dying. But in 2011, author Jani Scott published a biography on Obama's mother, and in it she wrote that Dunham's fight was over disability coverage, which was not affected by Obama's health care law, and not over medical insurance coverage. Scott had had access to Dunham's letters to her insurance company. For more on our 8 years of fact-checking Obama, see our website. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Albuquerque oncologist Dr. Barbara McEnany didn't like the trend she saw in her 3,500 patients that she treats every year. When her cancer patients suffered illness and side effects, those who were hospitalized or even treated in an emergency room came out sicker.
If a cancer patient walks into the emergency room, studies have shown that they have between a 1/3 and 2/3 chance of getting admitted. Because ER doctors are used to taking care of people with heart attacks and having babies and gunshot wounds and car accidents. And our patients come in and they're skinny and they're bald and they don't look healthy. And they take one look at him and go, my gosh, you look like you need to be in the hospital.
She realized that a problem was in the hospital themselves, far more lethal to those with compromised immune systems like cancer patients. She thought, what if I offer weekend support for all of my patients, allowing those patients to avoid a trip to the emergency room? She launched the Come Home model, which stands for Community Oncology Medical Home, offering weekend office hours where cancer patients can be seen and treated immediately by clinicians familiar with their case. She found those patients were often admitted to the hospital when they really didn't need to be.
So I wrote the triage pathways so that we could discern which patients really did need to go to the emergency room. You sound like you really are having a heart attack, so you really need to go to the ER. But you sound like you're having chest pain because you have bronchitis and you're coughing. Now your ribs are kind of sore. We can fix that. You can come here.
She said cancer patients are already under pressure of massive medical bills and loss of income. Unnecessary hospitalizations were creating an enormous cost. The Come Home model has saved her patient population some $18 million in medical costs.
We started with the triage pathways, coming up with a systematic way that sends people to the right side of service for what they need.
The program has been lauded by former CMS Administrator Mark McClellan, who says it provides a robust framework for better care to Medicare patients. The American Society of Clinical Oncology recently announced a collaboration with Come Home to help other oncology practices lower cost and improve quality of care at cancer facilities around the country. The Come Home model, treating cancer patients suffering symptoms from treatment with timely and targeted care that is sensitive to their unique health challenges, saving money while improving the patient care. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.